Hello, this is Jen Ramage welcoming you to KUSP. Today on the program, we are joined by Daniel Ellsberg, the man whose revolutionary act of releasing the Pentagon Papers to the public helped to end the Vietnam War. Daniel Ellsberg began his career as the coldest of cold warriors, working first for the Department of Defense, the Department of State, and the RAND Corporation. But in October 1969, Daniel Ellsberg set out to turn around American foreign policy by smuggling out of his office and making photocopies of the 7,000-page top-secret study known as the Pentagon Papers of U.S. decision-making in Vietnam. Now for the first time, Daniel Ellsberg tells the full story of how and why he became one of the nation's most impassioned and influential anti-war activists and how his actions helped alter the course of American history. Welcome to the program, Daniel Ellsberg.
Very good to be here.
At its core, your new memoir, Secrets, a memoir of Vietnam and the Pentagon Papers, really traces and then documents a high-level deception by the U.S. government in its foreign policy, looking at 30 years of involvement in first Indochina and then Vietnam. At the same time, it is also this journey of personal and political transformation by one person. How did you come to put all this on the page?
You mean, how did I come to write a memoir about it eventually? Yeah. I'm so used to being asked over 30 years, how did you come to put out the Pentagon Papers at that time, that I'm not entirely ready. It's how I began to put it out as a book here. Really, I felt it was time. I didn't know when I was writing it that it would be as timely as it's turned out to be. Actually, when the hardback came out just a year ago, I found myself moved to put a chapter, the first chapter of this, on the web, which my publishers had mixed feelings about doing since they were just starting to sell it. I wanted to put the chapter in about the Tonkin Gulf deceptions because as I saw was happening in Iraq, we had been lied into a war, just as once again, 30 years later, we were being lied into a war. That was clear to me. And I wanted to alert people that if they had suspicions, they should trust those suspicions. That presidents do these things. The Tonkin Gulf chapter, which I put on this website, Ellsberg.net, www.ellsberg.net, mm-hmm. revealed that on my very first day in the government as a full-time employee, I heard my president say a number of things about the Tonkin Gulf, each of which was untrue. Yes. He said that destroyers had been attacked on a routine patrol in international waters, an unprovoked attack, and there was unequivocal evidence of it. And that in his response, which was to start bombing North Vietnam for the first time, we seek no wider war. And I knew that each of those assertions was false. Unfortunately, I didn't put out what I knew then to Congress. I didn't even think of it, of doing such a thing. Here we were in Iraq. As I said, I could see again that the new president, this time a Republican, was like Lyndon Johnson and like Richard Nixon after Johnson, was lying about his purposes for going to war, the prospects of it, the intentions. And we were being deceived into war, essentially. I've really spent the last year taking advantage of the fact of this book being out, a book tour, to try to tell people that I inside the government in particular, that I hope they would come to the same decision that I had eventually. Too late for me in a way, but later than it should have been, but not too late to have an effect. And that was to tell the truth to Congress and to the public with documents. I hope that there's a lot of room for that left to be done.
Your book has a lot to bear on the current events in Iraq and the calculated policy by the executive branch once again abusing its power in the name of national security. Let's talk about your journey. I think it is something we can all learn from. The majority of your book initially centers on being special assistant to the Assistant Secretary of State, John McNaughton. And of course, this is when you heard your DOD and then later the president kind of lie about the Gulf of Tonkin. And you also center a lot of your time at RAND, where you analyze nuclear policy. From there, you have a unique insider perspective on just how many things are classified as secret and how much information on a routine basis in a democracy is withheld from the American public and from Congress itself.
Yes, working in the Department of Defense for Assistant Secretary of Defense John McNaughton, I became aware, and in years after that, was confirmed over and over. And this will sound like hyperbole, but it's not, that the proportion of papers that are stamped secret or confidential or top secret or higher in the government, which, and we're talking here about billions of pages. It's hard to imagine, but billions of pages. Going back in some small degree to the Civil War, certainly to World War I, and a lot to World War II, Korea, Vietnam, still classified, as well as now. The proportion of that that actually deserves protection, at least after months or a year or two, and we're talking, as I say, about things that go back 30, 50, 70 years, the proportion is probably like much less than 1%, meaning 99% of that material not only doesn't need to be kept secret, and perhaps usually never did, but is wrongly kept secret. It's much of that is information that the public needs to know to hold the government accountable, to judge its policies, to exercise the vote wisely, and other processes of government. And it's being withheld from them wrongly, which is to say that people who are keeping their promise, as I did so long, to keep those secrets from the Congress and the public, I think are behaving wrongly as citizens of this country. They're keeping their promise, which they made in good faith, as I did, but I certainly know that I kept it longer than I should have, and people died as a result, and that's a heavy burden to bear.
And you're talking here about a new kind of patriotism, a new kind of citizenship, one that we could apply today and ask the Bush administration to follow.
It's funny to call it a new kind in a way, because it's the kind of patriotism that I think that the founders of this country had in mind, that the country they wanted people to be patriotic to was not a monarchy. It was not a dictatorship. It was not a country in which one man had the power of deciding whether we go to war or how long to stay in war. They gave that power exclusively to Congress. That was a constitutional invention of theirs, and it was very wise. We've gotten away from it, and patriotism has come to be defined, I've found, as obedience to a boss, as obedience to the president, as if the president were a king.
So that's what you faced 30 years ago in Vietnam,
yes.
What you saw. Where are we today, 30 years later?
We're reliving that experience to a considerable degree, because not only have we once again been lied into a war, to a, I'd say, by the way, an endless and wrongful, unnecessary war, which has no clear end to it any more than Vietnam. I actually think we will stay reluctantly for the public, but there will be American troops in Iraq for a long time because of the oil there, essentially. I just don't think that it'll be easy to drive us out of there by any nationalist movement. We'll be occupying. We'll be essentially invaders. It'll be like a colony, a resistant, restless colony. A war will be going on, in effect, for a very long time. Well, that's tragic and wrong. But the other part that we're reliving, and that's reliving Vietnam, it'll be even more dangerous for people at home than Vietnam was, because the Viet Cong did not do acts of terrorism in this country. And I think there will be acts of terrorism in direct response to our occupation of Iraq. We've increased the likelihood of that rather than reduced it. Another parallel, though, is that people are speaking out, and one in particular is a former official, a retired official, Joseph Wilson,
right,
who spoke out to give the lie to the president's statements, as I did give the lie to a number of previous presidents with the Pentagon Papers, has in recent months been subject to direct attack by the White House, not only discrediting what he's saying to the best of their ability, which isn't very great because he's a very, very creditable figure, has worked for both. His first ambassadorship was under Bush's father, and who commended him very, very highly for that. And he's a long-term Foreign Service officer with great credibility. But they are actually taking criminal acts to intimidate him, to punish him for speaking out, for telling the truth about their lies, and to intimidate other people from putting out information. The very reasons that the White House had for hiring thugs, among other things.
Yeah.
But from another point of view, CIA assets from the Bay of Pigs and elsewhere, Cuban Americans who'd been CIA contract employees for a long time, to take a number of criminal acts against me to shut me up and to intimidate other people. So Wilson is standing now exactly where I stood 30 years ago.
It's striking to me. We are, of course, talking about this idea, too, that national security somehow overrides constitutional guarantees of our Bill of Rights. And You look at what the Nixon administration did first in its initial injunction, the first time ever, for the publication of the Pentagon Papers with the Times and the Post and eventually the 17 other papers. But then latter, of course, with your own prosecution. And you say in Secrets that Nixon Justice Department was making really a pioneering experiment, asking federal courts to violate or ignore the Constitution or, in effect, abrogate the First Amendment. Seems like this is all happening again.
Very much so. One difference is this. A number of the acts that Nixon took had his aides take against me, such as going into the office of my former psychoanalyst to get information with which to blackmail me into silence, or using the CIA to do psychological profiles and to provide, by the way, materials, disguises, and other things for this illegal burglary. That was illegal because it was against an American citizen. The use of warrantless wiretaps on which I was overheard, all of these were illegal then. They're not illegal now under the Patriot Act, under Bush Jr.'s Patriot Act put forward by John Ashcroft. Those acts are all legal. The president now doing the same things against a dissenter or someone who is revealing his lies would be not breaking the law, and he wouldn't have to cover them up. Nixon did have to because they were crimes then, and those cover-up crimes were among those that brought him down and actually made it possible to end the Vietnam War by getting him out. What's striking about the Wilson case is that despite what the Patriot Act allows the president to do, which is to allow very specifically the CIA to operate against American citizens, allows warrantless wiretaps, allows warrantless sneak and peek entries, as they say, burglaries for the gang. It doesn't allow what they just did to Wilson. That was a clear-cut crime. They revealed the identity of Wilson's wife as an undercover CIA agent, operator, and there is a law against that.
And they're still resisting having a special prosecutor appointed to the case and asking that the Justice Department take over the investigation.
I've been saying when I comment on the Patriot Act, I make this point that it has so expanded the range of what a president can do in the way of repressing dissent, in the way of invading our privacy and intimidating people variously. But I've said, you know, I have no doubt, though, that they're doing things that go beyond what the Patriot Act allows them to do. And indeed, so it turns out. The Justice Department has decided that it will conduct a full-scale criminal inquiry. Yeah. This has the potential of bringing down this administration, which I must say, from my perspective, would be a very good thing. Mm-hmm. But it would be very legitimate grounds for bringing down this administration and for putting people in jail just as people went to jail for Watergate. Mm-hmm. Certainly revealing a covert operative puts all of her decades of networks abroad at risk of their lives is very, let's say, questionable in itself, keeping in mind that many CIA covert operations should not have been done, should not be done, and sabotaging them, even by the president, might not seem such a bad idea. In this case, we don't know all the details, but she is said to have worked for years to get intelligence, secret intelligence, on the spread of weapons of mass destruction. Right. Now, that's something that does need doing. The national security is very much at stake in there. I do not want to see an effort like that interfered with. And that's what the president has done, or the White House has done, I should say. So when you said earlier that they're acting as if national security overrides the Constitution, no. That's their cover story. Yeah. That's their appeal. They want to tell the public, yes, these things we've done were for national security. They may have been illegal and unconstitutional, but they were for saving lives. Yeah. You can't say that revealing covert operations to discover weapons of mass destruction, revealing that serves national security. Quite the contrary. They use domestic security, domestic politics, to override the Constitution and national security.
This is clearly documented earlier in the Pentagon Papers when five administrations used their own domestic concerns and re-election concerns for what was continuing to be a stalemate and, an end loss in Vietnam.
Which is what we're going to have, by the way, in Iraq, a kind of stalemate. We occupied Vietnam eventually, and we're occupying Iraq now. Eventually, we put 550,000 troops there. Let me say, as a prediction from that experience, by the way, I do not think that any number of troops in Iraq are going to be able to suppress terrorist acts, or perhaps ultimately really quite military acts against them. I think that war is going to continue, and that's the definition of a stalemate in which many Americans will die.
You show in your memoir, Secrets, that there's this persistent discrepancy between the studies and the eyewitness accounts. Here you are, someone with access to all of the top secret documents over decades, also somebody who was on the ground in Vietnam watching how the war was waged. And your story was in direct contradiction to what administration was admitting, even if privately, like McNaughton certainly was among them, they were saying otherwise.
Well, that's right, and that's why there was a... Actually, to the extent that I was revealing secrets about the lies of Democrats, the president was quite happy to see that get
he
out.
He certainly was.
As you've seen in the quotes there, he was really... He wanted to get more out.
Yes, he was happy to leak as long as it was against Kennedy, not against his policies.
As he said... I want to leak. I want to leak the stuff about the Democrats. I want to leak about Kennedy. I want to leak about the murder of Diem. But then, and leak about me to deter other people from putting out secrets about his administration.
Henry Kissinger at one point said that you were the number one enemy of the U.S.
Yeah. So then he says, "Here's a quote from the tapes which I got access to as part of my book research. What we have to develop now, I've heard this on the tape, a program for leaking out information. We're destroying these people in the papers. This is a game. It's got to be played in the press. That's why Mitchell can't do this. Mitchell, the attorney general, who did go to prison for his crimes, but he felt he was too legalistic, as the president said. So Haldeman said, it's got to be a guy you can really trust, because it's got to be Nixon, run from the White House without being caught.
Yeah.
Well, I think tapes in the White House over the last couple of months would have picked up exactly pretty close to those words in this operation. Whether who the president was talking to or who was giving those orders, we don't know exactly. Right. It could have been Karl Rove. It could have been his Stephen Card. It could have been other people. It could have been Condoleezza Rice. That remains to be seen. Right. But somebody was breaking the law, and they hope to do it without being caught. I think they are going to be caught.
Yeah.
And that could be the downfall of this administration, and it couldn't happen to a sweeter bunch of guys.
Well, Daniel Ellsberg, let's look at your journey in particular, because we must ask ourselves, is history dependent on one person being brave enough to challenge what is going on, as you did? You spent over a year photocopying the 7,000-page document. It's detailed in secret, specifically the covert way in which you had to cut off top secret on every single page so that you could photocopy it with some anonymity.
My daughter did that a couple of nights, actually. She was 10 at the time.
And you start by approaching people like Senator Fulbright, then Senator McGovern, trying to get it in the record legally, fully aware that you could go to jail for the rest of your life for disclosing such information, but feeling that you had no other choice. That what was going on was, in your own words, an evil, and you needed to expose it. Is history dependent on brave people like you doing these revolutionary acts, or can administrations and bureaucracies evolve?
When you talk about history being dependent, of course, first of all, when I'd been in Vietnam, I'm surrounded by people. I was in the field a good deal, having been a Marine company commander at one point. So I'd had good field training, let's say, and I used that in Vietnam to see the war up close. And one thing I saw up close was bravery by a lot of people. On both sides, by the way, some rather astonishing bravery by the Viet Cong that we were confronting, which is described in the book. But certainly bravery that was almost routine among the people around me. That's what we expect of our young men that we sent over there, and we get it. And I'm sure there's a lot of that in Iraq, bravery on our side, and what I have to regard now, as in Vietnam, as a bad cause. I think they were lied into it, and I hate to say that. And I'm glad that more did not die on both sides and on our side, but I foresee a lot more death ahead, people being lied to death. In that context, then, the question you're really asking is there a need? Is there a need for people to show the kind of bravery in civilian life?
Yeah.
And bravery involved in telling truths that your boss doesn't want told or that the president doesn't want told? The answer is yes, there is a need for that. I'm glad the need is being met by not only by Wilson and others who left the government, but by many people who are putting out secrets that should be exposed, mostly, however, without documents and without exposing themselves in the way that Wilson did. And the efforts against Wilson here are clearly meant to, maybe not all of our readers quite realize one of the issues here, Wilson's wife having her career exposed and all of her operatives over the years have now been exposed by this, not by her fault, is a terrible stress on Wilson. It's a punishment of Wilson. And the purpose of that is to keep these other people from coming out. Right. Or from being like Wilson. Well, I would say that we need, in other words, it's hard to say what is sufficient, you know, does history depend, but it's necessary if we're to get out of the calamitous situation we're in Iraq for others to behave like Wilson and not to be intimidated by what's happened to him. Rove or someone mm-hmm. is trying to tell people, look what'll happen to you. We play hardball, and we don't obey by the rules, and we don't obey the law, and that's what you're going to have to deal with. I hope there will be others who do what I wish I'd done much earlier than I did. Go to Congress, go to the press with documents or with your own voice, your own authority, like Wilson, and tell the truth. A war's worth of lives may be at stake and may be saved.
There's an idea that human sacrifice is required of each and every generation to make the democratic process meaningful. You're asking people to rise up as you did, whether or not you think it was too late, not enough. You changed the course of a war, and you did it at a great personal sacrifice. It's an admirable thing.
Thank you. You know, I didn't pay a really great sacrifice. There were some sacrifices I could point to, but I didn't suffer what Nixon had in mind for me, which in the first instance was 115 years in prison,
right.
In which case, with good behavior, I'd be getting out in 2008 after 35 years. Although it was a friend of mine paid me the compliment of saying that she wasn't sure I would have gotten out in yeah. with good behavior right. From prison. But he had more than that in mind for me, to blackmail me in various ways and to possibly force me to leave the country if he could, or commit suicide. That was one of the aims of the plumbers, the yeah. people whose job was to stop leaks for the White House at any cost. Leaks of presidential lies is what they were trying to stop. What we clearly have here now is another set of plumbers in the White House. Mm-hmm. The White House plumbers of Watergate fame are back.
As the public awareness grew with the release of the Pentagon Papers, we can only hope that our understanding of this situation continues to grow. Daniel Ellsberg, author of Secrets, what do you hope people take away from, first and foremost, from your memoir, from these 500 pages of self-reflection?
That truth-telling can be powerful, even though it's rather likely when it's a whistleblowing, that is to say, going outside channels, going outside the organization and telling things that your team, your colleagues, your boss, above all, the president, doesn't want told. That almost always does have risks of various kinds. Risk-taking in that context can be well worthwhile. You can even feel it as an obligation, but in any case, it's something that should be considered. You shouldn't rule out telling truths, even truths you've promised not to tell, where lives are at stake. When your silence risks lives, you should be ready to take those risks. And you can do that. You can do that with the knowledge from this book, I think, that it can be effective, even when all the odds seem against it. What I've been saying in this in our talk here, based on the events of today and yesterday, it's extremely current.
Yes.
Is that I think that Joseph Wilson's act of truth-telling in an op-ed to the New York Times yeah. on July 6th, right. some months ago, we're slowly here.
People can Google it and read it.
I think it may have a very big effect in saving American lives by keeping us out of other wars that this group of people had in mind. It will be harder, I think, may well be harder for them to lie us into the next war, whether it's against Syria or Iran or North Korea or wherever they had in mind. So I think it may be, and this is not only very effective, but this is a very good time for other people to do the same. I don't think anyone can read this book last year or this year without recognizing that we're reliving a great deal of this, the governmental lying and the war and the wrongful war and so forth, the hopeless war. And I would hope that that would not inspire just a hopeless sense, we can't seem to change these things, but a realization that many, many Americans did work together or on an individual basis, but they went to prison, they marched, they demonstrated, many of them told the truth eventually, in a way that was effective in ending the war. And that can be happening now. That's the challenge to us.
Well, on that note of hopefulness, thank you, Daniel Ellsberg, for joining us here today on
KUSP. Thank you for having me.